Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.
Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. With this month being the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II in Europe, that's May 2020 if you're listening in the future, I thought I'd squeeze in an extra episode. Partly as a thank you to all those who sent me kind words of encouragement and also to those who signed on to become patrons of the podcast at patreon.com/WW2podcast or www.podcast.com/support. In this episode, I'm going to be talking to Marie Benedict. Marie emailed me last year to suggest I might want to have a chat about Clementine Churchill. Now, I've read a biography of Clementine and the letters between her and Winston Churchill, and I've always been fascinated by their relationship. While in some respects Clementine might not be an obvious World War II topic, in others she was at the centre of the war effort, as the letters between Clementine and Winston demonstrate. They were very much a double act. Anyway, it's taken me 6 months to get round to reading Marie's book, simply titled Lady Clementine. Marie, thanks for joining me. Clementine Hozier, what is her family background? I assume she's aristocratic.
One of the things that really attracted me to Clementine from the start was her really unusual background. You know, she came from this aristocratic family. Her mother was a Stanley. They had a castle, the Airlie Castle. Her peers, her family members were all very often titled, very often very moneyed. But her own immediate family situation was very different from everyone else in her sort of class, in her peer group. Her mother, Blanche, was very unusual. She didn't come with any money to her marriage to Henry Hozier or Hozier, but she came with a unique attitude. You know, her mother was, she was a self-dubbed bohemian. And kind of what that meant was that she did not think that her marriage should stop her from having her extramarital dalliances. So at any given time, it was rumored she had multiple other paramours. I read somewhere, I didn't include it in my book because I couldn't substantiate it, but that she had 10. And obviously what that meant was that her relationship with Henry Hozier, her husband, was not long for this world. She did have 4 children during that marriage. Clementine, who was the second child, she had an older sister, Kitty, and then she had there were a set of twins after her, Nellie and Bill. They were all born during the marriage, but there was a lot of questions around the paternity of the children. So, you know, not only is she kind of growing up in this aristocratic background, not only does she sort of come from that background, but she's so different because her immediate family doesn't have a title. They don't have enormous funds. And then there's sort of this stigma, this cloud following her and her siblings about their actual parentage. And then once her parents divorced, because of course the relationship wasn't going to last through multiple dalliances, once her parents divorced, which again was very uncommon for the time, they you know, really fall into even more monetary problems. And they sort of move throughout her childhood from France to England and back again, as her mother is sort of, I don't want to say chasing, but following her relationships and also escaping from creditors. They had bills her mother couldn't pay. Her mother had a gambling problem. So she was often moving the family to kind of escape people she had debts to. So while on paper, you know, when Clementine and Winston married, she was sort of dubbed this aristocratic beauty. And she did hail from a very well-known sort of noble background. But the reality of her life was so different from how it looked on paper.
So where did she meet Winston Churchill? Because in some respects, they're not, from a financial point of view, they're not necessarily dissimilar.
You hit the nail right on the head there. I think they were actually very similar in some ways. I don't think probably they really sensed that from the moment they first met. But I think as their relationship developed, those similarities of both of them kind of being outsiders in their world. You know, they both came from these really aristocratic backgrounds, but neither one of them had really any money. And both of them had mothers who were very interested in their own extramarital relationships. So I think those things in some ways kind of bonded them together. But in terms of their actual meeting, they met on March of 1908. They actually met at a dinner party. I mean, they had met in passing before this, but where they really first had a conversation was at a dinner party hosted by a woman by the name of Lady St. Helier, who was actually Clementine's mother's relative. And this woman really took it upon herself to help out the girls of her class who needed help in society. And so even though Clementine's mother, Blanche, had no money for Clementine to kind of come out in society in a formal way, Lady St. Helier would provide opportunities for Clementine to socialize with people of her class. And this dinner party was one such occasion. Lady St. Helier had arranged for Clementine and Winston to sit next to each other at dinner. But true to form, Winston was very late to the party. And Clementine, I think it was like the second or third course by the time he finally arrived. The reports are that even at that very first meeting, they really had an instant connection between them. They really did. And I don't think it was just, you know, kind of love at first sight type of connection. Clementine had a love of politics, which of course was Winston's lifeblood. And I think they really just sort of bonded over similar interests, similar passions. And then I think there was this undercurrent of similarity of the two of them really being outsiders in their aristocratic world.
Mm. Yeah, because it's peculiar. They are sort of social equals, but as you say, they are sort of social equals, but they have no money. You say she's political. My assumption is they broadly had the same political views. Do we know what her views are, or is he so big that her views are swept out of the history books?
Oh, no. I mean, Clementine, throughout the course of her life, she was a liberal. So I really think because of her background, you know, she came from really in many ways, she knew wealth and she had a name, but she also knew poverty and she had a great empathy for laborers or people of a different class than hers, which was uncommon. You know, most of the people of her class at that time were not everybody, but a lot of the people were conservatives. And she was a liberal. And not too long before she and Winston met, he had switched parties from conservative to liberal, which was a huge scandal. And then he remained a liberal for many, many years. And so during that time period, their views were very much aligned, except for the women's right to vote, which is a whole separate question. But she was very much in support of the women's right to vote. One of the things that she liked about him is that prior to their meeting, he had come out publicly saying that he would vote in support of the women's right to vote if, in fact, the majority of the male constituents supported it, which, of course, he knew was never going to happen. But at least he had come out in some ways supporting that. And then, of course, he backtracked and all sorts of other things happened. But so really at the beginning of their relationship and for the next couple decades, they were very much aligned in their political views. And in fact, when he switched parties again and became a conservative, it was very hard for her. She was very, very involved in his political affairs. And she had to find ways to support him in the way that she had, the way that they had sort of grown accustomed to interacting. You know, she really was very involved in his political world. She really had to find more common grounds as time went on because they no longer shared those core political views.
Do you think she was ambitious, perhaps for herself, or was she just ambitious for Winston? Did she see her world through him, as it were?
I think she knew she had no choice but to see her world through him. There weren't opportunities for women at that time to be political. I mean, there were no models really for her. The closest she had as a model was probably Eleanor Roosevelt. Most of the wives of political figures that she knew were not involved in their husband's political affairs, not really involved, not like she was. I don't think she saw an outlet for herself individually. And so her mode of expressing her interest, her ambitions, her views, her power had to go through Winston. He was like the vehicle through which she could express her own views and power. But that said, she was nobody's milquetoast compared to him. I mean, she was probably, I think, the only person that could yell at him and he would listen. He was the only person that would suffer really serious disagreement with him and would come around to her, to a different point of view. She was kind of, I think, reserved in public, but she was a force to be reckoned with.
Well, I was going to say, I had written down, did she sort of intervene on his behalf quietly sometimes in the background, politically maneuver almost?
Oh, definitely. All the time she did that for him, all the time. I mean, she did it, you know, during World War One when he was ousted because of what happened in the Dardanelles. They needed a scapegoat. And Asquith, the prime minister, kind of offered him up. Now, certainly it was in part his idea, you know, other people supported him, but it wasn't really, he wasn't the reason it went wrong. The reason, I'm not a military historian, but it seems like there were certainly lots of factors that led up to the failure. But, you know, he was ousted, you know, he was given some title that had no power. And for somebody like Winston, who really believed that he was, you know, he had that sort of crazy vision of himself from childhood that he was destined to save England, which he did ultimately, but, you know, it's a little bit presumptuous at different points in his life. Here's Clementine faced with a man who thrives at being the epicenter of politics, who's been summarily removed from power, and everybody knows it. You know, it's all over the papers. And she really works behind the scenes to sort of restore his reputation. She writes to Asquith, saying, like, how can you do this to him? And she's having lunches and writing letters behind the scenes, seeing what she can do to kind of almost gather information to see how they might resurrect his reputation. So she did stuff like that all the time. And it was really her supporting the decision for him to go and fight on the front that really was the only thing that restored his reputation. But, you know, she had sort of surveyed the field and figured out that that was it. That was the only thing that was going to work. And she had to sort of squelch her own concerns and worries and anxiety to actually have her husband out there fighting, because she knew that that was the only way he was ever going to be restored to power. So that's a typical move for her, you know, to see what she kind of surveys the landscape, see where her husband needs information, needs bolstering, needs things to be smoothed over. And she takes it upon herself to do it, which is, I think, pretty uncommon for a woman from that time period.
Yeah, it's a political fixer almost. What would they call them today? They sort of a, you know, government advisor.
Yeah, I mean, she really was in many ways. I mean, he would vet everything with her. You know, she edited all of his speeches. He ran all policy by her. That's not to say he didn't have his cronies and his politicos that he really dealt with. But, you know, he always described her as the noblest of creatures, whether that was true or not. But she was almost like his moral compass. Everything had to be vetted through her to really see how he felt about it ultimately. And she knew him so well that she was able to see his foibles and his failings and, you know, reach in and help bolster that where she needed to. You know, that was nowhere probably more apparent than in World War II. When he started out as prime minister, he was horrific to the staff, just terrible. People were really upset in coming to her. Everybody would have a one-on-one with Clemmy, whether it was the secretaries or Jock Colville, who eventually grew to really love her, but they did not get along well at first. And she would kind of describe how important they were and how much Winston valued them, and really try and fill in the gaps. He had been kind of horrible to them. But at the end, even that wasn't enough. And she had to write him this scathing letter that basically said, you cannot go on like this anymore. And he listened and he changed. So, you know, whether it was in the political field or whether it was in his speeches or whether it was in the way he was managing and interacting with people, she was right there, you know, either helping him push forward in endeavors that they were kind of both committed to. But in a way, it was more than just, I think, bolstering her husband.
His natural reaction could be knee-jerk and she would smooth off sometimes what he'd spat out, you know, toned down the rhetoric. There's a story about, is it Admiral Callaghan who Winston fires and she persuades him?
Oh, yes. I think she, I think instead of firing, didn't she suggest that he have some, like an almost like an honorary title?
That's right. Yeah. It gives him a seat on, is it the Admiralty Board? So it gives him, takes one job, but gives him another, sort of keeps him on side. And it could have just so well, you know, you could have just thrown somebody out and then you just made a new enemy, as you say. So sort of working as a social barometer, almost like a conscience that she's filling in for him.
Well, even though she herself wasn't always the most nimble with people, she was a good read of other people. And she could see the way in which, almost like in a chess game, how his action here could affect them as a political pair three moves down the road. And you're right, he was all knee-jerk, all in the moment, lashing out, making decisions, usually for the best. You know, he was a brilliant man, but there were certain aspects of his personality that were really his Achilles heels. And she was able to see through and past that and help him make decisions that were better for the long run, better for whatever their shared goals really were.
You know, do we know how much Winston unburdened himself of the stress of office on her? Because, I mean, if he hadn't got past the First World War, that was stressful enough to have to, no doubt, to have to live with him. Never mind also through the Second World War.
Yeah, I think, well, here's the weird thing about both of them, really. And it was something that they had in common, but it's an uncommon thing. I think both of them did better in very stressful, very tense, very high, you know, moving, fast-paced situations. Both of them did better when they were in the thick of things, when things were urgent. You know, in World War One, World War Two, it was really like the best of them shone out in those times. And it was during the down times, during the times when, you know, he's in his wilderness years, or that time in particular, I think that were the most stressful for them as a couple. It was almost as if when they could unite together towards a common goal and be acting towards it really as their primary focus, that's when they really came together the most as a couple. It was in those down times when, you know, doesn't have a focus for his energies, when he doesn't have any political power. Those are the times that become the most challenging for them as a couple. And it's certainly during those times that he unburdens on her. He's really hard during the 1930s to deal with.
Well, she does suffer. Is it a breakdown? Is it nervous exhaustion? I'm not quite sure what they call it now or then.
They didn't have the same kind of diagnoses that we did then. I would say she had an anxiety disorder, if we were going to put it in more modern terms. I think probably she was like hardwired from that, from her youth. And I think throughout the course of her life, her anxiety would kind of rear its head periodically. And she would take these trips away. She would call them rest cures. We would think of them more as like mental health breaks. Sometimes she would actually go to an institution, like almost like a spa type thing, but definitely trying to deal with sort of your mental health issues. She took trips like that several times during the course of her life. I think one of her children described her, I can't remember which one, almost like a violin string that was pulled, that was taut, almost ready to snap at all times.
So if you're like a violin string pulled, taut, ready to snap, how do you deal with Winston Churchill when he's having one of his, I mean, he used to call them his black dog times, isn't he? His depressions. How did she cope with his depressions?
I think structure. During those, you know, their worst times were probably those wilderness years. I think her mental health issues were actually worse than his. But I don't think it was acceptable for her to have them. So they weren't really described that way or brought to the forefront. Back to your question, I think, you know, during the 1930s, which I think in many ways were their worst times, I think up until, you know, he started to assume positions of power again, I think structure and order were her way of dealing with him. You know, they had a very, you know, everyone's heard the famous stories about his two-hour baths every day and his crazy, you know, working all night, sleeping in the morning. Everyone in the whole house was kind of structured around his schedule. And it's not like she went to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and got up at noon, but she made sure his schedule was running exactly the way he liked it. And that kind of helped deal with his depression and kind of helped keep him organized. And she you know, went to bed really early, got up really early. So very often they would be communicating with each other throughout the day through notes that they would leave, but they might only ever see each other at lunch and dinner. So I think that was really her way of managing him during those times. When they were both sort of in World War I and in the early 1920s, and then in World War II, he may have had flare-ups, but I think they were both on their game during that time period. They were both really functioning at their highest capacity with these lofty goals in mind. And I don't think it was as much of a problem.
I love the idea of sort of writing little messages to one another. It's kind of like modern day texting, but in slow motion.
Totally. And you know what's great about that from a, you know, just from a book writing perspective? Is there's a million letters between them. Because not only did they have lots of time apart where they would write each other long letters, you have all these short little notes where you can see what they're concerned about on a day-to-day basis. And rarely is it something like, what are we having for dinner? It might be like, oh, I had an idea about how we can help move forward this policy. What if I schedule a meeting with such and such admiral? You know, it's great. You get to actually see more day-to-day what their lives
Fantastic.
Were like.
So if we get to the Second World War, she stays in London throughout the war. Was that her decision? Why did she not remain in their family home at Chartwell?
Oh, she would never have left his side, and he would have never tolerated her leaving his side. They were together almost always. You know, she had in the bunker, the war rooms, she had her own room. I'm sure you've seen them, her own room down there. It's right next to the war room. I mean, he really wanted her to be available always for him to consult. She would never have dreamed of leaving. And he really was in many ways kind of lost without her. And that's not to say he wouldn't go off, you know, to one of the big conferences, the Cairo conference, the Tehran conference, without her. Sometimes she did go on the conferences, much to, I'm sure, everybody else's dismay, but sometimes it really wasn't appropriate for her to go. And so she would stay behind, but he would always prefer her to be there. You know, she was very often the only woman at dinners, the only woman at meetings. Certain of the people who were in, you know, really at the epicenter of World War II, would say that she had access to more confidential information than really almost anybody, because he really just wanted and valued her opinions on things.
It's a heavy burden. You kind of have to share it with somebody, don't you?
I think so. I think so. And I think in many ways, even though they had certainly had their ups and downs over the years, they were each other's perfect partner in that respect, because she really cared about what he cared about. There were plenty of other spouses of key political figures who didn't want to hear about the nitty-gritty of this military decision or that policy or the machinations necessary to make them happen. But she not only wanted to hear about all that, she wanted to participate in the machinations. I mean, just take as one example, you know, during World War II, before the Americans got in after Pearl Harbor, England was pretty much fighting alone for a while. And they weren't sure how long, how long it was going to last. And they knew that they needed to get the Americans involved. FDR, America was really still in that very isolationist mentality, not willing to get involved. And so the two of them really mounted a campaign to really woo the Americans. You know, that was really a very much a concerted effort on both of their parts to become close with Harry Hopkins, FDR's right-hand man, to become close with Avril Harriman and Gail Winnett, the ambassador. You know, they forged close personal relationships, not just Winston, but Clementine too. They would host them. They would lavish whatever food they could scrounge together on them, because they knew how important that relationship was. And I really do think it was that concerted effort that ultimately led to the Lend-Lease Act, which, you know, really provided financial military support during that critical period.
Mm. She does carve out her own niche in the war beyond Winston, though, as well, doesn't she? She does other things and champions other causes.
Yeah, she does. I mean, again, it kind of goes back to those early days where she kind of had her eyes out for the people who were more on the margins, you know, because she herself had kind of been on the periphery, not really, but kind of. And she was, you know, was looking for the things that weren't being tended to properly, at least from her perspective. And she would sort of take it upon herself to use the connection she had, the power she had, which of course derived from Winston's power, behind the scenes to kind of make things happen. You know, just as one example, we talked about a little bit earlier with the shelters during the Blitz. Winston loved to go out after a Blitz, a bunch of bombing had happened. He would like to go and almost be like a first responder on the scene. And Clementine, people were very upset. The staff, everybody was really upset that he was doing that. And Clementine decided they couldn't get him to stop it, that the only way he was going to take any kind of safety precautions was if she joined him, if she actually went out there in the middle of the night in her pajamas, just like him. He was in that crazy siren suit he wore. And here they are tromping around in the rubble. It was during that time that she really got a sense of what the shelters were like and how the people were living hours a night, night after night, week after week, month after month. And, you know, she saw that. Right, probably rightly so, much of the nation's focus was on the war itself, the fighting, but the people weren't really being tended to properly from her perspective. And so she kind of took it upon herself, along with the Red Cross and whoever else she needed to reach out to start to have some more sanitary precautions, some more necessary comforts, latrines, bathrooms, things like that, that really weren't in place prior to that. So that's like kind of one project she would become involved in. I don't want to say behind the scenes. It wasn't like it was a secret, but it wasn't something she really ran by Winston either. It was a problem she identified. She wanted to take care of it, and she used her access to do it.
I wondered, you're in a world of celebrity, it's easy to think that everybody knows who, you know Michelle Obama, you know, the spouse of the premier, is almost an instantly recognizable name. I wondered if during the war, if previously the spouse of a prime minister had been very much in the background, if during the war she comes to the front, how do we know how well known she was at the time? Was she driving things forwards in her own name?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because I definitely don't think people knew that she had her own projects. Not the public anyway. I mean, I think what Clementine did understand is that the populace, the general population of the world at that time wasn't ready for women to be taking leadership positions for the most part. So what she did, she was doing behind the scenes or in a more limited environment. But I think even from her relationship with Eleanor Roosevelt, I think she sort of comes to understand that she does have an important place, that contrary, from what I understand, and I'm not an expert on all the prime ministers that came before her, before Churchill, but most of their spouses were really in the background. They weren't super well known. They weren't, people maybe I could identify them, but I don't, from what I understand, of course, there's no formal role for the prime minister's wife, like we have a first lady. And so for the most part, their spouses were kind of in the background. Well, I don't think that Clementine wanted her projects necessarily to be known. I think she wanted the people to know she was there for them. And while it wasn't like she was giving huge speeches, she did give speeches sometimes, but not widely, at least not until later in the war. I think she did want people to know that she was there to support them, that their leaders knew about them. Even if you take what she was wearing at this time, it's hard to find pictures of her. There's so many pictures of him, but when you do find pictures of her in public situations during the war, she's always wearing two distinct things. One is she always wears this crazy bandana around her head. And when I first started to see those, I was like, what is she wearing? Because prior to that, she'd always wear like cute little hats, which is what most of the women were wearing. And then when I did some research, I learned that these scarves, these bandana things she was trying around her head, were the way in which the female factory workers who were, working around the clock to make munitions and armaments, things that were necessary for the war, that is what those women were wearing. And she adopted that sort of manner of dress, that sort of head, that hair treatment, because she wanted them to know, if they saw a picture of her, that she supported them, that she saw what they were doing. She literally recognized them. She saw them, because for most people, those women were really invisible and the work that they were doing was invisible. And then the other thing that she did, which again, I researched because her outfits were so odd. She started to wear during the war these crazy, really loud, lavish coats. One of the coats I refer to as, I don't know if this is a reference that'll mean anything to you, but it, like her from 101 Dalmatians, her Cruella de Vil coat.
Yes. I could picture the coat in my mind.
Do you know what I mean? It's this crazy Dalmatian-y furry looking jacket. And she starts to wear this in these cheetah print coats. And again, they weren't things that she wore before. They were very intentional choices. She wanted to wear something that wasn't dour, something that was, in her mind, bright and eye-catching, to sort of lift the people's spirits. So she started to sort of self-identify as a public figure. And while she wasn't about to tout her accomplishments, and I think she knew that those things weren't going to be super palatable at that time, she did want the people to know that she was there for them and that they were supporting the people. So it's interesting. In her own way, I think she started to kind of almost come up with like her own little brand. It's very unusual for the time.
Yeah, it is. It is now. You got me thinking about it. I had a quick search on pictures and I was quite surprised how sort of few there were. I just expected there to be an enormous amount.
Well, you know what's funny is when I'm glad actually you did that, because one of the things I give a lot of speeches, and one of the things I talk about is how iconic he is, how visually iconic. We have seen so many images, photographs of him with his hat and the V for Victory sign and the cigar, and yet he's almost always alone. Almost always. Occasionally we have those iconic images of him with Stalin and FDR, all seated, of course, because FDR couldn't stand. But when you look for images of him with her, there are a few that you can find, but you have to look really hard to find them. And I think that's really telling about the way in which women were treated, identified, thought of during that time. Because if you actually know a little bit about the scope of the role that she played during World War II, the images shouldn't always just be Winston alone. It should be him with her most of the time, because she was there. I mean, it's really unusual how present she was, even by today's standards.
Well, it's curious because in today's world, the spouse of a leader is nearly always wheeled out at some point, and then from time to time, the rest of the family in tour is as well, to sort of portray some form of normality. Although, to be fair, the whole of the Churchill family, I think, are involved in the war effort by the end of the war, aren't they?
Because Clementine insisted. That was all her. She wanted everyone, including the girls, to be in the war in some capacity. And they all were. I mean, one of the things Clementine did do behind the scenes was advocate for women to have more substantial roles in the military. And there were other groups doing this, but she really was one of those voices kind of calling for that. And Sarah, I think, worked with maps in some capacity. And Mary was, she worked with some of the, she worked in London and in various other areas, but she was more on the ground involved. Diana had a role. Randolph, the errant Randolph, he was involved as well. So yeah, everybody had to participate in the war effort. And she was adamant that everybody in their extended family, even if they weren't working in the war effort in some way, that it wasn't like they could escape to another country. One of their, I think her, Winston's brother's son's child, they were trying to go to Camp Flea and go to Canada. And she's the one who stopped them from leaving. She said, you know, you can't, you know, the people need to have faith in Winston's leadership. What does it telegraph to them if his own family is fleeing the scene? So she could be really tough when she felt strongly about something. Mm.
It's a really amazing that she doesn't get more spotlight time. I mean, I have a very old My Darling Clementine. I'm not sure when that was published, which I read a long time ago.
Oh yeah, that's a good one by Jack Fishman.
Yes, with an introduction by Eleanor Roosevelt.
I love that book. You can't even get that in print anymore. I have it online, but that's a great. It's almost like it's a great. It focuses on her, of course, but it operates almost like as a memoir of their time together. Great insights. And the introduction by Eleanor is terrific.
And there is a book of, they did at some point publish a book of letters as well between them, which are wonderful, which I can't find my copy of. I did try to find it.
Oh, that's wonderful. That was one of my primary sources. That Mary Soames, their youngest daughter, she published more like memoirs of her relationship with her mother and her relationship with her father. And then she published those letters with, they're annotated. So those are just terrific. Really, really wonderful. Letters are always my favorite as a way to kind of get the character's voice, get the sorts of things they're talking about, thinking about, working on. And those letters were really priceless.
It wouldn't have surprised you if he came across belligerent and difficult, and actually sort of comes across that it's a tremendously loving relationship comes through in those letters.
Very much so.
Which is a very much seemingly as equals, which is, again, for their period, for that period, might not otherwise, you know, might not have been what you might have expected.
Definitely not. And not what you would expect in a relationship with him. Like, when you think about him and you think about how tough he was and how hard he was on people, Clementine is like the exception. And I think that in part was really that they really did truly love and respect each other. But his perception of her and her intellect and her worth and her morality, they were very much political partners.
Mm. Well, my last question was good. I think you just answered it. Was going to be, you know, what do you think the secret was?
Oh, gosh. You know what? I think it was exactly that. I think at their core, they both wanted the same thing. They both wanted to do the best that they could for the people. They really did. They were ambitious, for sure. But at the end of the day, their ambitions were to move the needle forward in a positive way for everybody. And I think they knew that about each other. And in many ways, because of their similar, unusual upbringings, they both really needed somebody in their lives, somebody who loved them unconditionally, who they knew would never really go anywhere, even though Clementine, of course, has her little dalliance. And I think that sort of solidity, sense of respect, and shared commitments, shared values, I think really were what knitted them together. They certainly had their ups and downs. There were many times, you know, there were reports about her throwing things at him and him screaming, and times when they needed to be away from each other. But at the end of the day, they had a very strong love and an extremely strong bond between them that I think was uncommon really for any period.
Well, that seems like a good place to end. Thank you. I enjoyed that very much. Clementine is such a fascinating lady. Folks, Marie's book is Lady Clementine. I will put a link on the website. This is a bonus episode, so watch out for a third episode to be released this month in just a few days' time. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
This week at Macy's, get an extra 20% off with your coupon or Macy's card. That's on top of already great deals, like 25 to 60% off cold weather gear for the whole family, 30 to 60% off select bedding and bath, plus 30% off select small appliances. And Star Rewards members earn on every purchase, except gift cards, services, and fees at Macy's, Macy's Backstage, and Market by Macy's. More at Macy's.com/StarRewards. Savings off sale and clearance prices. Exclusions apply.